I'm Jesse Thorne. Welcome to The Turnaround. It's the show where I interview interviewers about interviewing. It's produced by MaximumFun.org. That's my company. And presented in partnership with CJR, the Columbia Journalism Review. This week's guest on the show is Errol Morris. You might never have seen his face, but you've probably seen his work. Even if you haven't seen his many, many, many amazing Oscar award-winning documentary films, he's also directed like 25% of all good television commercials. So you know him from somewhere. If you don't recognize his face, but you have seen his movies, you might recognize his voice. Because it's his voice barking questions off camera that is one of their greatest signatures. As he's shown in his writing the last few years, as well as in his films over decades, Errol is a born investigator. He is always digging, always trying to put pieces together, and always trying to make a story. He's been doing this for a few decades now. And he told me about the best single piece of advice he's ever gotten.
It's a good thing to remember. Hey, you, shut the fuck up. And I try to remember it during interviews.
You know, Errol Morris is one of those guys. He's a master of his craft, but he knows that at the end of the day, maybe he doesn't know anything about what he's doing.
What the fuck is an interview? I mean, I do not know. I remember reading once in someone talking about interviews, and the claim was that she had taken great pride in how well she had done an interview. And then she saw the same person interviewed by someone else, and they had gotten the same answers. And decided, well, wait a second, what exactly is it that I did, if anything?
All right, let's get into it. My conversation with the one and only Errol Morris, who joined me from a studio in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where he lives.
There's Errol Morris. Hi, Errol Morris. How you doing?
Probably the worst person to ask.
Oh, no. Something wrong, Errol?
No. I just think that I'm not a reliable reporter about myself.
Well, good news. Here comes an interview. We'll see how it goes.
Someone just asked me to do, I don't know, it's Phil Cummin asked me to do a piece about interviewing. I sort of decided to interview myself. Why not?
Well, okay, so what was the first time that you found yourself interviewing someone? Do you remember?
Probably my mother.
It's, what were you interviewing your mother about?
Perhaps, you know, it's that basic fundamental question, what's for dinner?
Okay. In a professional or academic capacity.
Yeah, can there be anything more fundamental than that?
Dino Buddies is always the answer at my house. It's a type of dinosaur-shaped chicken nugget. It's the only thing my children will eat. Hot dogs sometimes.
So my son for a long, long time was very much into white food. I think the sign of dinosaur chicken nuggets, I'm not sure how they fit into that.
So your first film was Vernon in Florida, right? I'm not
nope.
Nope. Jeez Louise.
Nope.
I should probably have notes in front of me.
Gates of Heaven.
Gates
See
of Heaven
if I can
came
remember.
First. Okay. So Gates of Heaven grew out of basically you running into a newspaper article about this pet cemetery that was going to be disinterred.
Correct.
En masse.
But I was already interviewing people. The interviewing preceded the filmmaking.
So what kind of interviewing were you doing before you were filmmaking?
I was interviewing mass murderers.
As a hobby?
I don't know. It's hard to figure out that dividing line between profession and hobby. I'm sure you know the feeling.
I'm feeling it right now. So what precipitated you interviewing mass murderers?
I was still a graduate student. Maybe once a graduate student, always a graduate student. That's a frightening thought. I was a graduate student at Berkeley, and I was entertaining the possibility of a PhD thesis on the insanity plea. And lucky me, in the Bay Area at that time, there were all of these mass murderers. I don't know. Do you want to call it low-hanging fruit?
Sounds like you just did.
I guess I did. There were three of them. There was Ed Kemper, Charlie Fraser, or Herbie Mullen. And I interviewed all three of them. And I'm trying to get my chronology right. It's hard for me just to remember what happened a couple of hours ago, let alone 40 or 50 years in the past. I had been an undergraduate at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And in those days, everybody talked about Ed Gein. Ed Gein was the famous mass murderer on the block, the man that Psycho is based on. Ed Gein came from a small town in central Wisconsin, Plainfield, Wisconsin. And not so far away, a writer, Robert Block, he was there at the time that Ed was arrested. It's at the end of the 50s, and he wrote a novel about him, which he calls Psycho, and was adapted into a movie by Alfred Hitchcock. As it turns out, one of the greatest movies ever made. That was the beginning, really, of my obsession with talking to mass murderers. I interviewed mass murderers in California, and then I arranged to interview Ed Gein. I had already graduated from the University of Wisconsin. I was in Berkeley. Sorry if this is a terribly roundabout way of telling a story, but I went back to Wisconsin. It was the allure of Ed Gein. I went back to Wisconsin and I interviewed him several times at Central State Hospital for the Criminally Insane in Waupun, Wisconsin. And I got bitten by the interview bug. Something endlessly fascinating about interviews. Still fascinating about interviews. And if you ask me why, I think I could come up with a variety of answers. I'm not sure any of them would be true or would really reflect the reason why I do it and continue to do it, even though I complain about it constantly. Like, why am I doing this? Enough already. Fuck this. But I started these interviews, and one of the things that's impressed me over the years is people will say, I mean, I sound like Art Linkletter or something. People will say the darndest things, you know. People will say the craziest, the batshit craziest things, at least to me. I've been privileged over the years to hear things that are just quite, I don't know how to put it, outstanding. And I could give you, I don't know, a representative sample if you were interested.
Absolutely.
So you were supposed to say yes. Say please.
Yeah, well, you set me up. You set me up to set you
yeah.
up. Yeah. I'm here to help.
The rule of thumb was that if you shut up and let people talk, hard for me because I'm a nonstop talker. If you shut up, let people talk, within 3 minutes, they will show you how crazy they really are. A friend of mine, fellow graduate student in Berkeley, Charlie Silver, really gave me the essence of the technique. He once said to me, you can't trust people who don't talk a lot because how else would you know what they're thinking? So by letting people talk, I would create almost a stream of consciousness narration. And I had these Sony tape recorders, cassette tape recorders, and you had, depending on which kind of tapes you bought, essentially you had an hour on each side. 1 hour, you flip it over, you get another hour on the other side. And my goal, this was a kind of crazy goal. My goal was, can I do interviews, if you want to call them interviews? I'm not sure what to call them. Could I do an interview where the person talks to me for 60 minutes uninterrupted by me, without stopping? It's kind of the pure essence of something. It's not quite interviews. I guess in an interview, there's supposed to be a kind of yin-yang thing going on. You know, you say X, I say Y. There's an interchange of ideas. That didn't interest me so much. Maybe there's very little of the David Frost, Dick Cavett in me. I just wanted to hear him talk, and I didn't want to hear me say anything. And I achieved this objective, I'm proud to say, a number of times. These tapes without my voice on them. And I got to the point where I would do almost anything to keep an interview going, gesticulating wildly, making grotesque facial expressions, anything. But please, whatever you do, don't stop talking to me. I need you to continue. I interviewed Ed Gein's neighbors. I actually went to live in Plainfield, Wisconsin. I interviewed a whole number of other murderers in the Wisconsin area. And in fact, I'm writing yet another book to be entitled Murderers I Have Known. It was my favorite argument against the death penalty because I would lose some of my closest friends.
Were you scared to talk to murderers?
It depends. I mean, this is the answer, of course. It depends on context. When I was making The Thin Blue Line, I was talking to David Harris, who had just been released from San Quentin, living with his parents in Vidor, Texas. And it became pretty obvious that David Harris was the real killer of this Dallas police officer. I'd interview the guy who, you know, was convicted of the murder, but he, in fact, was telling the truth. He was the lamest excuse in the book. I was home in bed sleeping, but in this instance, it turned out to be true. So I'm interviewing the guy who turns out to be the real killer. And our first meeting, how much detail do you want?
I just genuinely, I mean, like, my mom does work in prisons sometimes, and I've never gone with her. She goes to San Quentin, which is probably
I was going to ask you whether her work was as an inmate or otherwise.
Yeah, she does work with prisoners. She supervises the license plate group.
The license plate group.
Taking her a long time to earn that.
Yeah.
But she, you know,
sounds like venture capital.
she goes to prisons, and I've never gone with her because I'm scared to go.
Oh,
and
don't I'm be like silly. You're not scared to go.
I am scared
You're
to go.
You're not scared to go.
Yeah, you bet I am. Absolutely, I'm scared to go, Errol. I'm not joking.
What do you think is going to happen to you?
Like, if somebody said, you have to go, I mean, not just because I got sent to prison, but like if there was some really, really if there was a powerful reason, you know, if the prison chaplain said, you know, all the prisoners love listening to your NPR show and they really want to meet you. It would really change their lives. You know, one guy wants to get out and become a podcaster.
Yeah. I think that's extremely unlikely, but I like the idea.
Yeah, so like if that scenario came up, I guess I would do it, but I would be scared to do it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't do it voluntarily because I was thinking about maybe doing something related to it for my PhD. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So what I genuinely want to know, were you scared?
No, I was scared of David Harris. I like David, but I knew that David was the real killer. Maybe I didn't know it absolutely 100% for sure at the beginning of our quote-unquote relationship. But I knew it pretty damn quickly, and at the very least, I suspected the likelihood of it. The first time we met at a bar in the swamp near Vidor, and I had gotten his number from... Actually, the parole officer refused to give me his number. I gave her my number, and he called me within, I would say, minutes, and we arranged this meeting. On that occasion, I was scared because I did something which I think is, well, I don't even think, I know is incalculably stupid. I don't know if you've had this experience. You're talking to somebody and you're afraid they're thinking something, something you don't want them to be thinking. So you tell them you're not thinking that thing that you're worried they think you might be thinking as a way of, I don't know, whatever. So I say to David Harris, I said, I'm really glad I had a chance to meet you because I can see you couldn't possibly be the killer. Fuck you, Errol. He gives me this look, like, it's the what the fuck look. We're sitting there in the middle of nowhere. He's talking about fucking the waitress, covered with tattoos, although he still has this boyish charm. He asked me about Randall Adams. This is the guy who took the fall for the cop killing. He asked me about Randall Adams. Had he been executed? Well, he came within 3 days of being strapped into old Sparky, the electric chair in Texas. No, he had not been executed. So then David wanted to know from me, does he have bad things to say about me? And I'm noncommittal. But I had this very clear feeling, this is the first meeting that I'm talking to the killer. I'm talking to a killer, and the killer kind of knows that I know he's the killer, or at least is considering the possibility that I know he's the killer. And I also think, what the fuck am I doing here? So if this is a question about, was I scared? Yeah. And then when I left, he said to me, I had driven, staying in a motel in Huntsville, Texas, and I had driven to Vidor. And I'd driven to Vidor, you can take the interstates, you go down to Houston, and then you take 10 across South Texas to Vidor in Orange, Texas. I decided to drive back just through these lonely roads in East Texas. And David Harris said to me several times, be really, really careful driving home. So someone says that to you once, you think, well, they're telling you to be careful driving home. They tell it to you three times. It's essentially a death threat. And I thought he was following me. I mean, I was really, 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 really scared. And finally, I came to a gas station, but there were people at the gas station in the middle of nowhere. It's still no cell phones, and go to a phone booth. It's just filled with a million and a half horrible bugs. I call my wife in New York, and I say to her, I just met with David Harris, and I think he's the killer, and he might be following me. And my wife, Julia, just started screaming at me on the phone. You idiot! But maybe I like this kind of thing. I don't know.
I mean, it seems like you kind of like it.
Yeah, I kind of like it. But this is different. It's a different question. Do you kind of like this kind of thing? And have you ever been scared by this kind of thing? And the answer is yes and yes. Yes, I've been scared.
I mean, it seems like above and beyond the murderer, not murderer question, you're really into talking to people who are, I don't know what the right word is, maybe iconoclastic, people who are out on a limb. And sometimes that means they
iconoclastic
are,
seems like a polite term for batshit crazy.
They're not. I mean, they're not always. I mean, if I think of like the people that are on the people that are in Cheap, Fast, and Out of Control or on First Person, not all of them are crazy. They're just.
Maybe I'm
one of a kind.
Maybe I'm the.
They have their own way of being in the world. Some of them, it seems pretty functional, at least from the outside, even though it's weird.
Yeah.
Some of them are murderers.
Yeah, I graduated.
Some of them are potentially mass murderer, arguably mass murderers.
Yeah, I graduated from the murderers to a more wider variety of people. But it was always the. It was always the crazy lines that interested me. Maybe it was always the idea of penetrating into some kind of weird alternative reality, of entering into someone else's head, which still fascinates me.
That makes sense to me, because if I think of, like, you made a short film a year or two ago about Mr. Met. A guy, I think he was a former Mr. Met, if I'm remembering correctly.
He was a fired Mr. Met. Yes, former and disgraced Mr. Met, pushed out of the job he loved so much by an unfeeling bureaucracy.
And the thing that made him so interesting was the depth and unusualness of his passion and commitment to wearing a giant baseball with eye holes cut out of it on his head.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, that's not exactly crazy.
Well, maybe we all do, except, you know, not in a literal sense.
Have we stumbled upon a powerful metaphor?
Could be.
The bull quote from this interview is Errol Morris, : we all have a giant baseball over our heads.
Don't forget the eye holes.
But when you're talking to someone like that.
Yeah, God in his great wisdom gave us these two holes in our skull so that we could occasionally peer out at what else is out there.
I feel like when you're talking to someone like that, it's a different thing than talking to somebody at the grocery store. Or do you feel like everybody is like this? It's just sometimes it's secret.
I don't know. There are people at the grocery store that I have so much wanted to interview. And I feel that it's a failure on my part that I really haven't done it quite yet. I have a house in western Vermont outside of Bennington. Please don't go up there and try to kill me. But there's this grocery store.
Hey, Errol, if I'm in southwestern Vermont looking for a celebrity, 100% it's going to be Luis Guzman.
Okay.
As soon as I heard that dude lives in rural Vermont, I was like, I got to plan a trip to stalk Luis Guzman.
There you go. The Price Chopper stays open all night So sometimes I drive up to Vermont and I arrive in Bennington at 4 in the morning, 3:30, 3, 4 in the morning. And the Price Chopper, of course, is open because the Price Chopper never closes. It's open 24/7. And you might ask yourself, what kind of people do you find in the Price Chopper at 3:30 in the morning? And I would have to answer the very, very best people you could imagine.
A game I like to play at the grocery store, Errol, is when I'm in the express checkout line, the 9 items or less line.
Yep.
Which is now inflated to a 12 items or less line frequently, sometimes even a 15 items or less line.
Right. Or it says, you know, 8 items and you have 9 and you lie.
Yeah. But I like to look at the things that people have in that express line, in their grocery cart, their basket, their order.
Of course you do.
Because there's a powerful story no matter what it is. No one has ever stood in the express line to buy 3 bananas, 3 apples, and 3 pears for their fruit bowl, which is the boring thing. It's always they're there and they're buying a box of tampons, an extension cord, and a knife.
You know? Yep.
There's never not a story in the weird group of things that you buy from that line.
Well, I do a lot of advertising. I mean, that's how I made a living for years and years and years and years. And you mentioned Miller High Life. Well, I've just done hundreds and hundreds of companies over the years. I estimate I may have done 1,000 commercials. It's a frightening thought. But people's relationship to the products that they buy is maybe that's the only real relationship we have anymore. Other human beings may have failed us, but the products are still out there on the shelves. Thank God. So for years and years, I did Quaker oatmeal. I did it for, I don't know how many years, 4 or 5 years. I think they wanted to fire me, except that the sales kept going up. And on one occasion, they had complained there was not enough product placement in the ad. So I filled the frame. The name for the Quaker Oats man is Larry, his internal name. I shouldn't even be revealing this. I'm probably going to be prosecuted for this. I hope you're happy.
I am thrilled.
His name is Larry, the Quaker Oats man. So I had, I don't know, in one frame, I had hundreds of Larrys, frame Larrys on the wall, huge 6-foot-high circular canisters of Quaker oatmeal with Larry on the side. Larry everywhere. And this girl came in. I was making these spots with real people. This is the only time it's ever happened to me that my cameraman said he could no longer do this anymore. He felt what I was doing was morally indefensible. Strong words, I might add. So I had this girl. Her parents were just getting a divorce. Why am I telling you this?
I'm interested. You can't stop.
She's standing in front of this 6-foot-high canister of Quaker oatmeal. She's looking at Larry. They're eye to eye. And I asked her, I said, this just shows that I'm a bad person, I'm afraid. What if I am a really bad person? Then what?
It'd be terrible if you found out on this podcast.
I know. That's what I'm thinking. So I say to her, you know this is a really difficult time for you. I know there's a lot of trouble in your family, but I want you to confide in the Quaker Oats man your feelings. I want you to tell him how you really feel. So she's standing in front of the huge cylinder, talking about her feelings. Oh, Mr. Quaker Oats man, I feel so alone. So my cameraman came up to me and said, you are having her confess to a logo. This is wrong. This is so wrong. I'm not going to do this anymore. But let me ask you, haven't you ever felt the urge to confess to a logo?
I mean, no.
Well, I'm a little disappointed to hear that.
Was that the nail in the coffin? Does that make you a bad person?
I don't know.
I mean, if I were going to confess to a logo, Larry is probably the one I'd confess to.
Why is that?
He just seems like a nice guy.
Yeah, he does. Sympathetic.
He feels he's as comforting as a warm bowl of oats.
Caring. Receptive to new information.
Nourishing.
What the fuck is an interview? I mean, I do not know. I remember reading once in someone talking about interviews. And the claim was that she had taken great pride in how well she had done an interview. And then she saw the same person interviewed by someone else, and they had gotten the same answers. And decided, well, wait a second, what exactly is it that I did, if anything? I don't know what to tell you. This came from, she probably wouldn't be interviewed by you because she doesn't like to be interviewed by anybody. It's Janet Malcolm, who had made the remark about thinking she had done a great job on an interview and then seeing someone else had done an interview with that same person and it was virtually identical to hers. Well, first of all, I've chosen to interview people that no one else would interview. So there's no control in that sense. I mean, I can't say what Mr. X or Ms. Y would have done if they had interviewed that same person. But part of it comes from a desire to know something about the person you're talking to. You're an investigator. I've often said that if you know the answer to the question you're asking, why bother asking it? What's the point? Life is so futile already without exacerbating the situation. There should be somewhere in all of this a desire to know more, to investigate, to find out. And as an interviewer, I think this comes from promiscuous, compulsive interviewing. And I would be guilty of that. This question arises, does the person really believe what they're saying? Does Sean Spicer really believe what he's saying, let alone the President of the United States? So over the years, I became utterly obsessed with the question of self-deception. Am I being given a kind of entrance into what people really think or how they avoid thinking certain things or how they want to present themselves to others? Is it a mixture of many, many diverse elements? And my job is to sort it all out. I also became obsessed with transcription. So when I first started interviewing, I would sit and I would listen to the tapes with a transcriber. I learned that there were such things. And I myself would transcribe the interviews. And I would become incredibly interested in how language was used. how people express themselves. And that interest continues to the present day. I don't think it's abated, alas.
Stick around for more of my conversation with Errol Morris. But first, let's hear what else MaximumFun.org has to offer.
Hello, Amita Patel.
Hello, Sean David Johnson. What's going on?
I think a friend of mine may have chronic pop culture deficiency syndrome.
Oh, no. PCDS? What are the symptoms?
Well, she doesn't know Wakanda from Westeros.
Shameful.
And she keeps confusing Aziz Ansari and Riz Ahmed.
Oh, my gosh. So sad. Kind of racist, too. But what did you tell her to do?
I told her to listen to our podcast, Inside Pop, of course.
Fantastic idea. A weekly dose of Inside Pop will help anyone discover the best in TV, film, and music.
Suffer from PCDS no more.
Inside Pop has you covered every Wednesday on Max Fun.
How many times has this happened to you?
Oh, man, if only I knew whether it was better to be too hot or too cold, or who the best James Bond was, that girl would have gone out with me.
Now you can with We Got This with Mark and Hal, the podcast from MaximumFun.org every Tuesday.
Hey, Lois, it's Joey. The best James Bond was Daniel Craig, and it's better to be too cold than too hot. Thanks, We Got This with Mark and Hal.
Only on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get fine podcasts.
It's The Turnaround. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking to the Oscar-winning documentarian, Errol Morris.
What do you notice when you look at spoken language on the page or when you're writing spoken language?
You see how people are wrestling with what they themselves think, what they believe or don't want to believe. It becomes a different kind of enterprise than just reading, for example, discursive writing. And in my movies and also in my writing, I've tried to capture something of that. I'm not sure how successful I've been. I know that I like my movies, the movies that I do like. I'm not sure how many of them I actually do like, but the ones I do like, there's a remaining mystery in each one of them about who that person I have interviewed really might be. I know one of the reasons I remain fascinated by the fog of war is I found myself really liking Robert S. McNamara, this person who I had actively demonstrated against at the University of Wisconsin in the 1960s. My feelings about the Vietnam War, about his policies, really haven't changed much over the years. I looked at it as an abomination then, and I look at it as an abomination now. But the fascinating part of it, I think for many people, they saw my job as somehow forcing McNamara to provide a justification for what he had done or to apologize for it, something like that. Just like, in this whole nonsense about the Frost and Nixon discussions, that it was Frost's job, some thinly disguised cleric, to force some kind of guilty admission. I find the idea really boring and besides the point, because I see my job as it being a very, very different kind of job. Namely, the job of figuring out who is this person? Who is Robert S. McNamara? Is he lying to me? Is he telling the truth to me? Is he lying to himself? And if he is, in what way? I felt that in making that movie, he laid bare this landscape, this mental landscape, incredibly suggestive and complicated. Never, thank God, have had the opportunity to kill millions of people, if you want to consider that an opportunity. As I often say, my grades weren't good enough. But what if you have found yourself in that position? What then? Here's the bottom line. Interviews give me an opportunity to think about stuff. They give me an opportunity to think about people, about myself, about who I am, who they are. I guess about what it means to be alive.
Why would you rather do that by talking to people and in your films showing people talking rather than showing people doing things?
You know, I don't know.
I mean, I think there's plenty of folks who would say actions speak louder than words or whatever, right?
Yeah. I mean, it is endlessly fascinating. I mean, when we talk about nonfiction filmmaking, documentary filmmaking, whatever you want to call it, well, we all know that there are endless varieties of it. It's a zoological garden of various different kinds of nonfiction and documentary. I remember reading In Cold Blood for the first time. I would say that that book, probably more than any other book I can think of, had just an incredible effect on me. Also, when Capote said that he could remember everything verbatim, you know, people would talk to him for hours and then he would just simply write it down as if he was a human tape recorder. And I got horribly depressed thinking about it. I thought, fuck, I can't do this. I'm not a human tape recorder. I'm just, you know, a kind of person. Big sausage patty with ears, with a limited ability to retain very much of anything except maybe urine. And I thought, you know, I need a tape recorder. And I want to be like Capote. I really would love to be like Capote, and I still endlessly admire Capote. One of the things that always bothered me about the Capote movie is that they suggested after In Cold Blood that he couldn't write anymore because he had expended his creative capital. Well, he continued to write. And he wrote really, really splendid stuff. Hand-Carved Coffins may be, along with In Cold Blood, a kind of definitive book for me. Well, it's a novella, whatever you want to call it. But thinking about the relationship between what we perceive, what we create, and reality. I ran into terrible trouble as a filmmaker when I made The Thin Blue Line because I used what they called reenactments. I showed the murder of this Dallas police officer, and I showed it from all kinds of different angles, and I showed variants of what might have happened. You might say Rashomon style. And people said, well, this is indefensible. That's not what documentary should be. Going back to what you said a moment ago, see, I do listen, that I had a choice between filming stuff that's actually happening and filming people talking. I had a lot of other choices too, but let's just say those two choices. And why the talking? Partly it's the historian in me, endlessly fascinated by the past. And if we're being scrupulously honest with ourselves, murder investigations, crime stories are a form of history. We're looking into the past and we're trying to figure out what really transpired, what really happened. It's a form of history. I used to get really defensive about the reenactment stuff. No longer defensive about it, maybe a little bit, much, much less so, because it occurred to me in a way, it's pretty self-evident, pretty obvious, that everything is a reenactment. Consciousness is a reenactment of the world inside of our skulls, inside of that bone prison where we find ourselves. And the reenactment isn't giving you reality on a plate, but it's giving you evidence so that you can try to reconstruct to the best of your abilities what reality might be. It gives you a way out of, if you like, Plato's cave or whatever you want to call it. So I think the reason for it is this fascination with that which has already transpired, with the past. The belief that there is no veridical way of telling a story about the past, or any kind of story for that matter. That you have a different kind of obligation when you're telling a story, an obligation to try to figure out what really happened, or what transpired, or what is real and what is imaginary. And you're allowed to use any tool in your arsenal of tools to that end, to figuring something out. And reenactments are a fantastic tool to going back, revisiting a piece of history, and in reenacting it, trying to figure out, could it have happened that way? Does this make sense? Are there pieces missing? Have I elided something, or has something been destroyed that I need to know about that would give me a purchase on what really happened? It's a way of drawing myself into, I suppose that's it for me. It's the mystery of the past.
I think also to some extent in your movies, you are interested in, you know, sticking in a pry bar and opening up the space in between identity and reality, reality such as it is, like looking in and seeing the ways that, as you said,
well, we all know that there is a real world out there. There's a Philip K. Dick quote that I love, and he said reality is that which remains after we cease to believe in it. I'm a great believer. I've just written a book, by the way, about realism and reality. A book which I never thought would have any kind of currency, but I believe it does have very strong currency in our current environment, where there are people in power all around us who are denying reality in one form or another. But to me, it's sorry to be grandiloquent here or whatever you want to call it, but to me, it's the highest human purpose, separating fact from fantasy, what's real from that which is not. It's one thing that, you know, we can say in commendation of our species, of ourselves, that we pursue that sort of thing. Otherwise, it's a pretty lousy enterprise.
I want to not run out of time without talking about...
Is this too desultory? Am I just all over the place?
As long as you can come up with a couple tips and tricks, I think we're in business. I think we got feelings down. Now we're going to do tips and tricks. This is the pencil to use. This is the question that always works. That kind of thing.
Yeah. I'm reminded of actually one of my favorite quotes. It was said to me by a police officer in Berkeley, California. I'd just been arrested in a supermarket for parking tickets and taken away in chains to the Berkeley Police Department. And the cop put me in this room. And I noted that there was a door handle on the outside, but no door handle on the inside. So I said to him, I said, officer, how come there's a door handle on the outside, but no door handle on the inside? And he looked at me and said, hey, you, shut the fuck up. It's a good thing to remember. Hey, you, shut the fuck up. And I try to remember it during interviews. Were you just about to say something, Errol? You know? Remember the immortal words said to you by that kind police officer in Berkeley years ago. Is that a good tip?
That is a pretty good tip.
You allowed to use the F word?
Yeah, I mean, it's a podcast. Fuck it.
You know, I think it's really unclassy not to swear. I'm sorry. God created these words not to some idle end. He created them so that we would use them in his goodness. You might say his knowledge of man and the world. He saw their necessity. He gave them to us joyfully, not so that we could hide them away in a cupboard somewhere. I said to my son when he was around 10 years old, he had told me that someone had said that he could better express themselves, or he could better express himself without using vulgarity. And I said, well, the next time someone says that to you, ask them how they could better express the sentiment, eat shit, asshole.
When you're tempted to ask a question, when you don't know what question you were going to ask or what you were going to say in an interview, and I imagine that comes up sometimes because you're sometimes, you know, some of these movies, you're interviewing people for days. What do you do?
I suppose you slowly digest your insides. I mean, I had this problem. I've had this problem with... It's never the what to say because I don't believe in lists of questions. In fact, I think it's a real, real bad idea to have a list of questions. When people ask me for a list of questions, I say, no, I don't do that. First of all, if you have a list of questions, it means that you're not engaged in listening to what the person says. You know, say they say something that inspires a question that's not on your list. Then what do? You know, pull the pin and jump on your hand grenade.
That's what they teach in journalism school, I think.
Exactly. With Rumsfeld, it's so hard to interview Rumsfeld and so fascinating. I mean, that's another great example. Well, for me, it's a great example, self-serving example. You know, how come you didn't challenge him more? How come you didn't, you know, hold his feet to the fire, whatever that might be or mean? What if the Enterprise is a different one of sort of capturing something of who he is, something of his essence? There's a line in Virginia Woolf's poetic novel, The Waves, which I've always loved, which he talks about netting a fin in a waste of water. It's a recurring image. And I often think about that. You don't know what the fin is. You don't know what you're going to hear if you've done it right. The strongest line in the Thin Blue Line is a line that did not come in response to any question that I asked. It was volunteered. And it was a line that just opened up the entire case. Without even having to say Emily Miller, eyewitness, who said that she saw the defendant shoot the cop, she basically tells you that she has committed perjury, that she was lying, and that her testimony had no validity whatsoever. But it wasn't in response to asking those questions, because I would never have gotten the kind of answer that I had gotten. It was never a question, did you commit perjury? Did you lie on the stand? Did you actually see this person? There's never anything like that. Allowing people the scope to say the unexpected. And by the unexpected, unexpected by me. McNamara, in the first, was it 5-10 minutes of my interview with him, comes out with the line about the firebombing of Tokyo. Our side won, or else I would have been tried as a war criminal. It didn't come out of my asking some clever question. Excuse me, Mr. McNamara. Do you ever see yourself as a war criminal? Come on, fess up. I think there are moments in my Rumsfeld film that I'm very, very proud of, because they speak of a certain kind of patience, an ability to listen. I often think that because I babble so incoherently and so much, that interviewing gives me that opportunity to do exactly what that police officer in Berkeley advised. Hey, you, shut the fuck up. But I've just done a 6-hour series for Netflix called Wormwood. And I've tried something new again. I'm not supposed to really talk about it, but I'm quite proud of it. I gave up the Interitron. There are interviews, but there's drama. There's scripted drama. There's a little bit of everything. But it's all just in service of trying to figure out a solution to a mystery. When I was just starting to interview mass murderers, I had attended the trial of a guy, Herbie Mullen, who was convicted of 10 counts of first-degree murder. You know, you look for the appropriate Hallmark card to send. Sorry about your 10 counts of first-degree murder conviction. This was at a time when there was no death penalty. There was, as they say, a hiatus for a whole number of years in the 70s.
On the plus side, there were more stationery stores then.
Yes.
Easier to find cards.
So I went to visit Herbie Mullen's father in Felton, in the mountains outside of Santa Cruz, after his conviction. I believe it was the day after his conviction. And Herbie Mullen never frightened me, but his father did. So we're up there at night in the middle of nowhere. And he said to me, are you going to see Herbie? I said, well, I think in all likelihood, yes, I am going to try to see him in prison. And he looked at me, he said, well, if you see Herbie, you tell him. He better watch out or he's going to be in big trouble. That's why I do interviews.
You really hit the time on the nose. We're out of time, Errol.
I feel like I feel like I did something that I should not do. I'm always filled with remorse, by the way. Probably not half enough, but to let you talk more and to be more responsive to your questions, since you are doing a podcast. And my apologies.
No apologies necessary.
I'm weak.
Man.
I'm undisciplined. And I just don't know how to behave myself.
I was just trying to shut the fuck up over here.
Oh.
I am so grateful that you took the time to do this thing. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Jesse.
That was Errol Morris. He's won Oscars. He's made all kinds of amazing things. I'm going to recommend to you two things that I love that Errol Morris has made. One is the movie Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control, which is a spectacular documentary about a guy who builds robots, a guy who studies mole rats, a lion tamer, and a topiarist, and also, essentially, the meaning of all human life. It's funny, and it's brilliant and wonderful. And I'll also recommend, he made this series of documentaries about sports for ESPN, originally for Grantland. And you can buy them for like $5 on Amazon. And they're the greatest short things about sports you will ever see. 5-10, I think one of them maybe is 20 minutes long. They're so great. I recommend them so highly. That's the turnaround. Hey, if you liked this week's program, please tell somebody about it. That's our marketing budget, people. You can find it on MaximumFun.org, on YouTube, wherever you find podcasts. However is easiest to refer it to someone, please do that. If you're listening to the show for the first time, subscribe. All our music given to us by Mobius Van Chalkstraw. You can check his stuff out at chopsmusic.com. The Turnaround, a production of MaximumFun.org, presented in partnership with the Columbia Journalism Review. Their mission, to encourage excellence in journalism in the service of a free society. Learn more at cjr.org, where you can find edited transcripts of all of our interviews. They also have a great podcast that you should check out called The Kicker. The creator of The Turnaround is me, Jesse. It's produced by Kara Hart and Nick Liao. Our senior producer at Maximum Fun is Laura Swisher. Our thanks to Kyle Pope, Emily Erskine, and Daryl Frost. We'll catch you next time on The Turnaround.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture. Artist owned.
Listener supported.